Last time we spoke about General Douglas MacArthur's operations against Western New Guinea, Operation Desecrate 1, and the death of Admiral Koga. MacArthur unleashed hell from the skies above against Hollandia and other key targets in the western parts of New Guinea. Accompanying this was Operation Desecrate 1, a carrier raid against Palau, followed by strikes on Yap and Wolai in the Eastern Carolines, all in order to prevent the Japanese from reinforcing Western New Guinea. Lastly, the Commander-in-Chief of the IGN, Admiral Koga, like his predecessor, met his end at the hands of an aircraft crash. But the Japanese had not just lost their Commander-in-Chief, they had also lost the Z-Plan to the Allies. The Z-Plan documents were taken by Filipino guerrillas and they found their way to Admiral Nimitz, who would put them to good use in the future battle of the Philippine Sea. This episode is the Battle of Kohima. Welcome back to the Pacific War Podcast week by week, and I'm your dutiful host, Greg Watson. But before I begin, I just want to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II, and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please, subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, the Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all of that, if you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I just released a full documentary on the Battle of Attu, and it's really a bloody one. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where you can find exclusive podcasts. Recently had a lot of viewers join up, so a big thanks to all of you. The last exclusive podcast found over there was a two-part series on the full history of the USS Enterprise, the Big E. But soon a poll will come up, and if you join quickly, you can vote on what the next episode will be. So please check it out. We are back in the exciting Burma front to start off this podcast. The Japanese attack against Imphal had been directed by the ambitious and, to be quite frank, the insane General Muraguchi Renya. General Muraguchi sought to seize Imphal by a combination of guile, dislocation, and surprise. Muraguchi needed to destroy the British Indian Army at Imphal while also cutting off their rear escape at Kohima. Operation Yugo was not going very well. Yes, I just made a terrible pun. The Indian troops were digging their heels in, providing much more resistance than expected. Added to this, the Chindits unleashed Operation Thursday, delivering a dangerous thrust into the Japanese flank. Now, last we left off, the Japanese 33rd and 15th Divisions were launching their first attacks against Imphal, while General Sato's 31st Division advanced northwest upon Kohima. Sato's intentions were to cut off the British Indian defenders by taking Kohima and seizing the vast depots and stores of Dimapur. To defend Kohima and Dimapur, General Slim had given the task to Major General Robert, whose HQ was at Dimapur. Robert had the Kohima garrison at his disposal, roughly 2,500 strong men, led by Colonel Hugh Richards since March 22nd. This was built around the 1st Assam Regiment. The 1st Assam Regiment was led by Lieutenant William Felix Bruno Brown, and they had orders to, quote, fight to the last man at the Jasami Karason position. Now, relief was going to be provided by Lieutenant General Montague Stopford, whose 33rd Corps, formed around the 5th and 7th Indian Divisions and the British 2nd Division, arrived in early April. Stopford planned to concentrate his men at Jorhat, about 105 kilometers northeast of Dimapur, where they could be ready to launch a counterstroke against Dimapur. A single brigade would be dispatched as soon as it arrived to defend the Nichagard Pass, about 13 kilometers southeast of Kohima, and on the road to Dimapur. They would support the 161st Brigade already at Dimapur and the 23rd Long Range Penetration Brigade of Brigadier Lancelot Perron, who was going to be reinforcing Kohima by April the 12th. Lancelot's group would disrupt and cut the Japanese lines of communication back to the Jinwen. Meanwhile, General Yamachi's 15th Division and General Saito's 33rd Division were on their way towards the Impal-Kohima Road. Due south of them was the Honda Raiding Unit, built around the 3rd Battalion of the 67th Infantry Regiment. Their job was to cut off the road at the Kangpopki Mission in the Urkhul area. Luckily for Honda and his men, they were able to dodge the catastrophic battle at Sangshak. His unit would reach the road by the 28th, blowing up a bridge near Kangpopki. There were other units performing similar roles, such as Colonel Matsumura Hiroshi's 60th Regiment, who were given the task of cutting off the road at Satarmena. After the Battle of Sangshak, the Hiroshi unit advanced through Lamu, Songo, Shongfel, Nunga, and Angam, cutting the Impal-Kohima Road at Satarmena by April the 3rd. There was also Colonel Omoto Kisasu's 51st Regiment, who advanced against Hill 4950 by March the 31st, encountering little to no resistance. After all of this, they advanced further and took Hill 4192 on April the 1st. Up in the north, the 3rd Battalion 138th Regiment had advanced through Laishi without much opposition while the bulk of the division approached Jessamy. On the 26th, Colonel Todakai Tsunoe's 138th Regiment crashed into defensive positions held by the 1st Assam Regiment, who held their enemy at bay for over 5 days. General Slim watched over the developments at Sangshak and Jessamy with great interest. Then a unit captured Japanese orders from Sangshak, confirming his worst fears. Within a week of the start of the Japanese offensive, it became clear that the situation in the Kohima area was likely to be even more dangerous than at Impal. Not only were the enemy columns closing in on Kohima at much greater speed than I had expected, but they were obviously in much greater strength. General Slim had expected a strike against Kohima by a Japanese regiment, but not the entire 31st Division, which was on its way.
"We were not prepared for so heavy a thrust. Kohima with its rather scratched garrison and, what was worse, Dimapur with no garrison at all, were in deadly peril."
Luckily, the rapid arrival of the 161st Brigade at Dimapur and the dispatch of the 33rd Corps to reinforce Kohima could give them a fighting chance. Both locations received attacks on the 26th. And over the next 5 days, both units held their own. But they had lost communications with Kohima, and recall orders could not be issued. An American colonel flew a Piper Cub to airdrop orders, which Brown finally received on the 31st. Brown pulled back on April the 1st, but Lieutenant Young never got the message. On his own, he ordered his men out.
"I shall be the last man,"
was what Lieutenant Young declared, and with difficulty, he got his company moving towards Kohima. No one ever saw Young alive again, nor was his body ever identified. The 1st Battalion 58th Regiment had also been dispatched from Urkhul on the 24th and would cut the Impal-Kohima Road at Tupima by March the 30th. After the disastrous battle at Sangshak, General Miyazaki ordered a battalion to head over to Pulomi, while the 3rd Battalion 58th Regiment advanced to Kohima via Chakabama, and the rest of his unit advanced to Kohima using the road. Saito planned to launch a two-pronged assault against Kohima, with Colonel Fukunaga Tene's 58th Regiment from the south, while the 138th Regiment swung around Naga Village to cut off Dimapur's road. This saw a race feed units into Dimapur before the Japanese could arrive. The first units of Major General Grover's 2nd Division arrived in piecemeal to Dimapur between April the 1st and the 11th. They came by a small-gauge steam train arriving at Dimapur in quite a panic. The undefended base area expected an attack at any moment, driven by rumors of an impending arrival of Japanese troops. Stufford's men were still several days away by the end of March, prompting Slim to order Brigadier Dormant Warren's 161st Brigade to rush over to Kohima. By April the 3rd, Stufford established his HQ at Jorhat, where he made a disastrous blunder. Stufford at this point was still under the belief that the Japanese main objective was to attack Dimapur. He had some false intelligence indicating Japanese units were at any moment in the process of outflanking Kohima. With this knowledge, he ordered the 161st to evacuate Kohima immediately. For the units currently at Kohima, they could not believe the order. Warren, Colonel Hugh Richards, and Civilian Deputy Commissioner Charles Palsy were aghast at, and vehemently, protesting the decision.
When told that the Japanese were outflanking Kohima to the north, Pauzi scoffed, retorting that if it was true, "My Nagas would have told me." Major General Ranking, believing that Stafford was making a large mistake, went over his head by calling Slim directly by telephone to petition him to leave Warren at Kohima. General Slim, perhaps unwilling to overrule Stafford, and in any case as convinced as Stafford that Dimapur was the Japanese main objective, confirmed Stafford's original order. Warren's 161st Brigade, which had been in the process of organizing the desperately needed defense of the ridge, left Kohima virtually undefended only one day before the Japanese attacks began. Had Warren's men been allowed to remain where they were, the trauma of the siege that would follow would have been greatly reduced, and the stranglehold that Sato was about to maintain on the vital road to Imphal for two long months would have been significantly weaker than it had turned out to be. Thus, reluctantly, Warren pulled his men back towards the Nikkagard Pass, leaving only Colonel Richards with his original garrison. Meanwhile, Sato's unit was rapidly advancing through the mountainous terrain of the Naga Hills. Japanese and INA reconnaissance patrols were able to help the unit forage for food on the go, adding to their speed. Perhaps they took some time to eat turtle eggs, like Wingate advised. Sorry, I just had to bring up that rather weird one. It's been stuck in my mind ever since I heard it. On the morning of April the 4th, the 58th Regiment began assaulting the southern edge of Kohima at GPT Ridge, while Miyazaki's other units were advancing through the hills and valleys leading into Kohima from the east. Colonel Hugh Richard alerted Stafford of the Japanese assault, who immediately realized his grave error. Stafford desperately sent Warren's men back over to Kohima. Yet only 446 men of the 4th Royal West Kents would manage to get to Kohima in time to help her garrison. They dug in on Kohima Ridge, which is really a series of hills running north and south along the road to Imphal, gently sloping saddles connecting each feature. Since development as a supply base a year earlier, some of its various hills have become known by their function. From south to north, there were JPT, the General Purpose Transport Ridge, Jail Hill, DIS, the Detail Issue Store, FSD, Field Supply Depot, Guki Piquet, and Garrison Hill. A northwest extension of Garrison Hill housed a hospital that became known as the IJH, the Indian General Hospital, Spur. Thick woods, interspersed with the towns and bases structures, covered most of these hills. Garrison Hill was terraced and landscaped, included a home, complete with a clubhouse and a tennis court, of the deputy commissioner for the area, Charles Pauzi. The Imphal-Dinapur Road skirted the ridge to the east before turning west past Garrison Hill. Treasury Hill and the Naga Village Settlement overlooked the ridge from the northeast. Those heights also extended north to the hamlet of Merima. Southward loomed the imposing Pulbazi Mountain, whereas 3 miles to the west rose a knoll topped up by the village of Jotsoma. Kohima Ridge thus was overlooked by surrounding heights, Pulbazi to the south, Jotsoma to the west, and the Naga village Merima to the east and northeast. The same night they dug in on the ridge, Sato had just launched an attack against Garrison Hill. The remainder of the brigade were not able to get in, and they would remain on Jotsoma Ridge to the west, where Warren had emplaced his mountain guns to support the defenders. On April the 5th, the action kicked up with Fukunaga's 58th Regiment attacking from the south, while the vanguard overcame the Shears Regiment sentries on Naga Hill to the north, where they successfully secured a place for the artillery at Naga Village. 4 mountain guns would support Miyazaki's attack, also allowing the Japanese to seize the GPT Ridge. In a surprise raid, elements of the 3rd Battalion, 58th Regiment were able to grab the Old Town part of Kohima and the Treasury Hill. As a result of this, Miyazaki wrongly assumed the enemy had simply withdrawn from Kohima, so he ordered his men to begin an advance upon Chesuima. This in turn gave the defenders some time to reinforce their lines. Japanese pressure on the perimeter increased on the morning of April the 6th, with repeated attacks by the 58th Regiment on Jail Hill. Heavy artillery and mortar fire quickly denuded trees of their foliage, snapping branches and scattering jagged splinters to accompany the whine and hiss of exploding shrapnel. By 11 a.m., the surviving defenders were forced off Jail Hill and down into a steep valley through which ran the road, and then up the relative safety of the trees to DIS Hill, where Major Shaw's C Company were desperately trying to dig in. The Japanese attack was relentless, and although they secured Jail Hill dominating the southeastern ridge of Kohima Ridge, they suffered extensive casualties, including Captain Nagaya, the commander of the 3rd Battalion, 58th Regiment, who was killed. Major Donald Esten was also ordered to retake Jail Hill with D Company, the 4th Royal West Kents. But by now, the Japanese had already dug in deeply into the hillside, and they could not be ejected without considerable expenditure of life. Easton took his company, and he dug them in around FSD Hill. Jail Hill dominated the southern edge of the ridge defensive lines. The disappearing tree cover quickly became a problem for the defenders, who were becoming more and more visible to the enemy. It got so bad, the defenders were soon forced to only move positions at night. A company of the 4th and 7th Rajputs were able to reinforce Kohima by the end of the night, yet overall now 2,500 defenders were surrounded by over 15,000 Japanese. The loss of JPT and Jail Hill also meant the defenders had lost access to water, excluding a small spring on Garrison Hill. Richards was forced to limit the men to a single pint of water per day. On the night of the 6th, a company of the 2nd Battalion, 58th Regiment, launched a frontal attack against DIS Hill, screaming wildly. The fire from the awaiting Royal West Kents scythed into the attackers, as did bombs from Sergeant Victor King's mortars, landing within meters of West Kent's positions. Miyazaki kept sending more and more men until some infiltrated the defenders' positions, ending in a confused hand-to-hand combat brawl. By dawn on the 7th, a counterattack from FSD Hill would be broken by a ferocious Japanese machine gun and artillery fire. Sergeant Major Haynes led a spirited attack against these positions, dashing 37 meters up the hill with a mixed group of West Kents and Gurkhas, bayonets fixed, lobbing grenades everywhere they could. Those Japanese who ran were cut down by waiting Bren guns. Those who stayed were burned alive as thin structures caught fire. The bakery, whose large brick ovens in peacetime produced several thousand loaves of bread each day, was most impervious to these tactics, but combat engineers destroyed the doors with the help of large quantities of gun cotton. Instead of merely blowing in the doors, the ensuing explosion destroyed the entire building. Only the brick ovens inside withstood the blast. Escaping Japanese were brought down by rifle fire. Unusually, two Japanese soldiers were taken prisoner, and although one died later of his wounds, the other provided details about the strength and dispositions of the attacking forces. Captain Shiroseto, Nagaya's successor, in charge of the 3rd Battalion, 58th Regiment, was killed. Over 60 Japanese were killed in this struggle alone, leading the men to mutter amongst themselves that this was a worse ordeal than Sangshak. One of the problems now encountered by the men of C&D companies of the Royal West Kents was the fact that hundreds of bodies lay littered across their position, some friends, but mostly Japanese, attracting clouds of slow-moving blue bottles that feasted on the carpet of corpses covering the ground. Attempts were made to remove bodies whenever it was possible, but snipers in sheer number meant that this was not possible to dispose of them all. As the days went by, the effects of artillery bombardment dispersed some of the remains, with the result that DIS Hill became an unpleasant place to defend at best, and a quite injurious one to one's health at worst. The West Kents attempted to burn the bodies at night, but this had a poor effect on morale, as the appalling smell of burning flesh drifted across the position. Where they could, the Japanese cremated their dead. Realizing his enemy was strongly entrenched, Miyazaki now decided to order his 3rd Battalion to turn back. Meanwhile, the bulk of Torikai's forces were reaching the battlefront, so Miyazaki ordered his 1st Battalion to reinforce their attack. Sato was now under the belief that he would be capturing the ridge at any moment, so he ordered Torikai to cut off the Kohima-Dimapur Road, within the vicinity of Zubza. Sato also dispatched the reserved 124th Regiment to Chesuima to get ready for the operation in the north. Torikai's 2nd Battalion advanced into the Dazuzu Valley, while their 6th Company occupied Zubza, effectively cutting off Warren's base at Chotsoma. During the night, the Japanese launched both real and jitter attacks against the southern perimeter. During the next morning, it was discovered Japanese soldiers had infiltrated back onto DIS Hill during the confusion of the night, placing soldiers and machine guns in a bunker on top of the hill. Despite the Japanese machine guns posted on top of this hill, a hero would emerge to knock them out. A fearless 29-year-old, Lance Corporal John Harmon, demonstrated the type of behavior that would lead within days to the award of a Victoria Cross, but also his death. Realizing that the Japanese machine gun could cause untold damage if left unchecked, he crawled up the hill alone, standing up at the very last minute to charge the Japanese-held bunker. Miraculously, the enemy fire tore into the empty air above his head, and Harmon reached the bunker door, coolly extracted the pin from a grenade, released the firing lever, counted to three, and on a 4-second fuse, he lobbed it inside. The occupants were killed instantly, and Harmon returned triumphant with the captured machine gun going down the hill to the cheers of his comrades. The Japanese would launch attacks throughout the day, gradually pushing the defenders up the hill towards Kohima. General Muraguchi then personally ordered Seiro to continue past Kohima and seize Dimapur. Now Seiro Muraguchi did not get along very well, but he reluctantly obeyed the command, sending his 3rd Battalion, 138th Regiment along the Marima track to Bokujan. Then all of a sudden, General Kawabe countermanded the order and instead ordered Seiro's battalion to rapidly be recalled. This would become one of the more famed what-if scenarios of the Burma War. What if Seiro had turned a Nelsonian blind eye to the counter-order? Or if he had delayed his official receipt for another 24 hours? Seiro was apparently happy to obey Kawabe, and he withdrew to Kohima partly because of his deep-seated animosity towards Muraguchi that led him to assume the army commander's demands were motivated solely by visions of military glory, which they were. Seiro's hatred at Muraguchi blinded him to the strategic possibilities offered by continuing his offensive through Dimapur. This lost for the Japanese a crucial opportunity for victory in 1944. The failure to secure Dimapur while the British were in a state of confusion at speed and scale of Muraguchi's march on Delhi was indeed, as General Slim recognized, one of the greatest missed opportunities of the entire Burma War. It led directly to the failure of the Kohima thrust, and it contributed to the collapse of the entire operation. It was largely the consequence of Seiro's lack of strategic imagination, framed by Kawabe's rejection of what he regarded as an attempt by Muraguchi to secure himself some undying glory. What he and Seiro, for the matter, failed entirely to see was that Muraguchi, for once, was right. The capture of Dimapur might have been the decisive strategic moment of the entire campaign, leading to a dramatic worsening of the British position reminiscent to what had occurred in Malaya and Burma in 1942. Despite the megalomania and terrible planning on part of Muraguchi, for even initiating this Operation Yugo, to not try and make it work was more criminal. For those of you listening, the overall narrative of the Pacific War has been the Japanese at the beginning did well everywhere, but then at some midpoint, come late 1942 or early 1943, everything just simply goes wrong for them. This is indeed the case, excluding the Burma Front. Within the Burma Front, the Japanese definitely had a chance to claim a victory. What that victory would have meant, who knows? Perhaps in an incredible twist of fate, India might have left the war. That would have certainly changed things for World War II in general. Now, on the morning of the 9th, the Japanese once again managed to infiltrate the DIS Hill, and again Corporal Harmon leapt into action and he mounted a solo attack to remove the threat. Covered by 2 Bren guns firing from his left and right, Harmon dashed up the hill. Frantically, the Japanese returned fire, but in their excitement, they fired wide. Harmon reached the trench, and standing 4 meters to its front, he fired his Lee Enfield from his hip and shot 4 Japanese dead, before jumping into the trench and bayoneting the 5th. He then stood up triumphantly, holding the captured enemy machine gun above his head, before throwing it to the ground. The cheers of his comrades reverberated around the hill. Harmon then nonchalantly began to walk back down the slope. Unfortunately, he had forgotten that with the denuded foliage, he was in full view of the Japanese positions on Jail Hill. Unheeding of the shouting cries of his comrades to run, he leisurely made his way back down to his weapon pit, only to be struck by a burst of machine gun fire into his back just as he was about to reach safety. Donald Eston ran out into the Japanese fire and dragged Harmon into the trench. Within a few minutes, however, the extraordinarily brave man had died. On that day, Warren dispatched the 1 and 1st Punjabs to break through towards Kohima, but they ran into a number of log-covered bunkers at Piquette Hill, held by the 6th Company, 138th Regiment. The Japanese fired upon them, causing 25 casualties by the day's end. Upon the ridge, the killing continued. Large numbers of fiercely brave Japanese from the 58th Regiment were killed by the remorseless chatter of the British brand guns, as during the night three successive assaults were made on C&D companies of the Royal West Kents, the Japanese being denied success by the interlocking fire of 8 Bren guns, whose red-hot barrels had to be changed repeatedly. Casualties on both sides were quite high, the Japanese attempting to gain access to the hill from the road by the use of ladders, seemingly undisturbed by their losses. On the northern side of Garrison Hill, the 138th Regiment also launched attacks against 8 Company. The attack was held, Bren guns, bayonets, and grenades in the darkness, bloodily halting Japanese ambitions. Victor King's mortars fired in support, and the bombs landed with superb accuracy in front of Major Tom Kenyon's position. It seemed for a while that sheer weight of numbers would overwhelm the much-reduced A Company, but the reliable Bren's considerable reserves of grenades, the accuracy of King's mortars, and the determined courage of the Royal West Kents denied the penetration so desperately desired by the Japanese. The exhausted men had made their way up the hills under Japanese sniper mortar fire. On the 11th, a company over at Garrison Hill were still managing to hold strong against numerous assaults over the tennis court. During the night, they were relieved by B Company. Meanwhile, Grover had finally assembled his 2nd Division of Dimapur and dispatched the Cameron Highlanders and the 2nd Battalion Durham Light Infantry and Lee Grant Tank Support to open the road back up to Warren's HQ. The next day, while B Company was repelling more assaults, the 1st Battalion 58th Regiment advanced upon Jotsoma from Palomi, but could not penetrate through the defensive line. At the same time, the 3rd Battalion 138th Regiment advanced to Gavuma, though it was likewise unable to break through towards the Kohima-Dimapur Road. On the 13th, which would become known to the besieged British garrison as the Black 13th, B Company continued to resist suicidal Japanese assaults across the tennis court. Japanese artillery managed to kill many men atop the IGH spur. Casualties were mounting. The Royal West Kents had lost a total of 150 men by this point. 3 Dakotas had tried air supplying, but they accidentally dropped atop the Japanese positions on Kohima Ridge. Over at FDS Hill, the situation was quite desperate, as the Japanese were squeezing the British from the ridge to prevent them from using supplies raining down from the sky. Captain Mitchell of the Rajputs was killed on the morning of the 12th, and the furious counterattacks against the Japanese who had infiltrated amongst C&D companies of the Royal West Kents failed to remove the intruders. A Company, after their short rest at Kuki, now moved to support C&D companies. That night, the Japanese attempt to rush FSD Hill. The defenders were ordered to wait until they could see the whites of the Japanese eyes before opening fire. During the lull in the fighting, Private Peacock from A Company dropped off, exhausted from fatigue. When he came around, he discovered that he was sharing his trench with a Japanese officer who had assumed that Peacock was dead. Unable to find his rifle, Peacock leapt on the officer and strangled him after a fierce struggle with his bare hands. Then, to make sure, he ran him through with the man's own sword. By the 14th, the SM Rifles relieved B Company over Garrison Hill, where Richards commemorated his remaining men for their bulwark defense.
By your efforts, you have prevented the Japanese from attaining this objective. All attempts to overrun the garrison have been frustrated by your determination and devotion to duty.
Meanwhile, a patrol of the 4th and 7th Rajputs had advanced up the Western Valley. The patrol had the unfortunate result of raising some expectations of relief of the ridge. To the fighting men still desperately resisting every Japanese encroachment, this made little difference to their lives. Instead, life and death continued their seemingly arbitrary, parallel journeys. The shattered hillside was now almost bare foliage, the remaining trees standing forlornly, others leaning drunkenly where shells had smashed the trunk or branches. The ground was churned with morass of mud, which the defenders shared with the rotting corpses, excrement and the inevitable detritus of war, scattered equipment, discarded helmets, broken weapons, and exploded shells. Yet the troops all knew that they had achieved a remarkable feat of endurance and resistance. On the 15th, the 1 and 1st Punjabs had finally broken through Piquette Hill and reopened the road to the garrison's perimeter. By the 16th, the 5th Brigade linked up with Warren's troops for the first time. The Japanese did not let up at all. On the 17th, they finally seized FSD Hill and stormed Cookie's Piquette, overcoming some depleted defenders with their sheer weight of numbers. It seemed the exhausted Kohima garrison were doomed, now crammed into a small area. Then B Company, the one in 1st Punjabs, with some Lee-rank tank support, arrived on the 18th, just in time to give the boys a fighting chance. Under heavy Japanese sniper and artillery fire, Warren and Grover's men advanced towards the besieged Ridge positions. The 1st Battalion Royal Berkshire Regiment made it to Kohima on the 20th to relieve Richard's spent garrison. On the 19th, the day before the 1st of the relieving troops made their way onto the position, hurricane bombers strafed the Japanese positions. Dakotas dropped ammunition, water, and food accurately on the ridge, and 25-pounders for the 2nd Division pounded away relentlessly, firing from Zubza. The relief took place in just the nick of time. The men of the 1st Battalion Royal Berkshire Regiment could not believe their eyes or noses as they climbed onto the Summerhouse Hill on the morning of the 20th. Warned by anxious defenders to keep their heads down, many gagged at the repulsive smell of death and excrement that hung like a repressive fog over the position, weighing the hill down with a stench of horror. As Japanese bullets and shells continued to fall, the weary veterans of the siege made their way down the gullies adjacent to the IGH spur, strewn with Japanese corpses, to waiting trucks guarded by Lee-Grant tanks. The fresh relief troops on the road were astonished by what they had seen. Red-eyed, unshaven survivors, they made their way quietly out of the trees, but were in no doubt witnessing the end of the first phase of one of the grimmest struggles of the entire war. The Indian troops called out, "Shabash, Royal West Kents!" in warm acknowledgement of what all the defenders of the Kohima Ridge had achieved, congratulating the tired, bearded scarecrows, even as shells fell amongst them, injuring some of the wounded again and killing some, even as they were being lifted into the trucks. As the trucks crawled down the pitted road towards Jotsoma and then to Zubza, before making their slow way down through the green mountains into the hot, steamy Dimapur, the exhausted survivors had long collapsed into deep, delicious sleep. Their ordeal was over. After 16 days of a brutal siege, 278 men had been killed or wounded in a small stand, but one that would prove decisive for the CBI theater. Yet that is all for today on the Burma front, as we now need to hop over to the Admiralties. The campaign for the Admiralty Islands was coming to an end. Now General Swift's division had to mop up the islands of Los Negros and Manas. Over on Los Negros, the 5th Cavalry of Papitalay had been pushing west towards the Papitalay mission since March the 14th. They were still encountering heavy resistance requiring support from heavy artillery and aerial bombardment. At 7:30 a.m. on the 15th, Troop A advanced under artillery and mortar concentrations towards their third objective without any resistance. Troop A dug in there, and Troop B sent out patrols 200 yards to the front. Yet, still no opposition was encountered. Difficulties of supplying the troops over an extended supply line, which consisted of 1.5 miles of narrow, rutted, and slippery trails, prevented further advance. Troop C, aided by a section furnished by the 82nd Field Artillery Battalion, took 5 hours for the round trip. The 1st Squadron's last objective was the largest knob, Hill 260, on which it was now estimated there were 100 well-entrenched Japanese. By the 17th, sufficient supplies had been brought up to enable Troop C, which had relieved Troop A, to push on towards this knob. After the usual artillery and mortar preparation, Troop C, protected in the rear by Troop B, which was dug in on the third objective, advanced to within 50 yards of the hill crest before being stopped by machine gun and rifle fire. Squadron Commander Lieutenant Colonel Charles E. Brady then dispatched Troop B north to envelop the enemy from his left flank. Although Troop B had to cut its way laboriously and noisily through the jungle, the envelopment was highly successful. The Japanese put up little resistance, and both troops moved onto the hill and secured it by 1:10 p.m. About 40 or 50 dead Japanese were counted, although the total, which was impossible to determine in the jungle, was undoubtedly much higher. The 1st Squadron's losses in that day's attack were 4 killed and 7 wounded. Meanwhile, patrols of the 12th Cavalry had been going around inland in the region southwest of the Papitalay Mission and Lumbrum. They found more resistance than anticipated. After failing to connect the perimeters, Troop A and B were landed at Chaparoan Point on the 16th, where more patrols advanced along the coast, also finding some resistance. Over on the Rossum Road, Troop F of the 7th Cavalry were seeing their fair share of resistance at a position 800 yards down the road. Though the cavalrymen were able to push through to the northern edge of the old Rossum, the Japanese fought so hard, Troop F was forced to withdraw. Because of this action, the position was bombed by the 21st, before a full assault was launched by the 1st Squadron 7th Cavalry. This time, the cavalrymen were able to secure the northern edge of old Rossum, with the support of artillery and tanks. On the 23rd, the squadron pressed their attack, gradually edging through Old Rossum. To gain 1,000 yards here, the Americans suffered 68 casualties. Then on the 24th, they yet again had to withdraw under increasingly heavy Japanese fire. Finally, on the 25th, the 1st Squadron, 8th Cavalry, relieved the battered men. After a heavy artillery and aerial bombardment, the Japanese defenders were finally broken. That day saw the 8th Cavalry suffer 7 deaths, 29 wounded. For the Japanese, it was close to 100. Overall, the 2nd Brigade had suffered 36 deaths, 128 wounded in the week of fighting over the Rossum area. They estimated they had killed 200 Japanese. The 2nd Brigade would patrol inland for the next 2 months, penetrating deep jungles, swamps, and high mountains. In the end, they would count a total of 586 dead Japanese on Manas. Meanwhile, General Chase ordered a brigade to complete the occupation of Los Negros on March the 21st. The 1st Squadron, 5th Cavalry, and the 2nd Squadron, 12th Cavalry, attacked southwest towards some high ground, due west of Hill 260. Troop C of the 12th Cavalry advanced towards Yadas Village, supported by Troop B, who performed an encircling maneuver against the retreating enemy. The 2nd Squadron, 5th Cavalry, would manage to clear the southern portion of Los Negros with an assault against Palapi Hill. All of Chase's units were successful in their assaults, though they faced tough resistance. For the following days, the Japanese would fight back against the invaders, and by the 25th, over 500 of them paid the price with their lives. Since February the 19th, 1,917 Japanese had died on Los Negros, while the 1st Brigade had suffered 143 killed and 408 wounded. There were also plenty of mop-up operations against the outlying islands, with the 1st Squadron, 7th Cavalry landing on Pi'ili Island on the 30th. The 1st Squadron, 12th Cavalry assaulted Coronite and Nidrilo Island on the 1st of April, and the 2nd Squadron, 12th Cavalry attacked Rambutyo on the 3rd. The 7th Cavalry faced heavy resistance from the 60-man garrison on Pi'ili. The 12th Cavalry found no Japanese on Coronite or Nidrilo, and only a handful of Japanese were to be found on Rambutyo. On the 9th of April, the 1st Squadron, 12th Cavalry landed on Pack Island, and with that, the liberation of the Admiralty Islands was now complete. In total, General Kruger reported 326 killed, 1,189 wounded, and 4 missing, while also counting a total of 3,280 Japanese killed and 75 captured. General Kruger would go on to partially explain the heavy enemy losses in the Admiralty's operation were likely due to:
our troops were gaining superiority on the ground against an enemy whose tactical knowledge envisioned only the offensive.
Allied tactics of guaranteeing naval, air, and artillery superiority to the troops in each operation was making the heavy proportion of Japanese casualties an expected result in the Pacific. In the Admiralty's invasion, fire from destroyers kept the enemy under cover during the landing, and artillery gave the troopers an enormous advantage against an enemy who possessed only 2 75mm mountain guns and 1 70mm howitzer. Terrible weather had greatly restricted air operations during the first week after the invasion, and the weather probably accounted in part for the weakness of enemy air defense throughout the campaign. But the constant pounding of Japanese air bases within the range of the Admiralty's was far more an important factor. General MacArthur's decision to send a limited number of men and ships to take an enemy stronghold, far in advance of Allied held territory and within striking distance of enemy planes, had proven worth the risks involved. At a very small cost, the neutralization of Rabaul and Kavieng was completed. And from the new base in the Admiralties, Allied air and naval forces could now launch surprise attacks on the Dutch New Guinea coast, and could threaten essential enemy sea lanes within a 1,500-mile radius, including the Marianas, the east coast of Mindanao, and the southern limits of the Celebes Sea. I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Want something rather exciting, bloody, with a lot of visuals? Check out my full documentary on the Battle of Attu. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where you can find exclusive podcasts. I recently had an influx of people join up, so a big thanks to you guys. I just released a two-part series on the entire history of the USS Enterprise over there, but now polls are going up for the next episode, so if you join up quick, maybe you can vote. Fate had rolled her dice yet again, and the Japanese had lost another decisive moment whereupon they could have perhaps changed the entire war in the India-Burma front. Likewise, General Douglas MacArthur gambled by attacking the Admiralty Islands, but it would pay off heavily. It seems the Allies were winning with every hand dealt to them.